Welcome to Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio. Join us as we explore books and culture through engaging conversations with writers, historians, and creatives, offering unique insights into the literary arts and beyond. Hosted by Ken Budd, Jennifer DeSano, and William Miller. Now, here's the show.
Hello, and welcome to Upstart Crow. I'm your host, William Miller. My guest today is Linda Chavez, author of the novel, The Silver Candlesticks. The book's subtitle is A Novel of the Spanish Inquisition. Welcome, Linda.
Good to be with you, Bill.
I want to tell you, your novel is much more riveting and revealing than that subtitle might suggest.
My publishers picked the subtitle, what can I say?
Did they do it with a committee?
No. The problem is Wicked Sun, which was my publisher, they publish mostly nonfiction. So they wanted to get a novel in there so that people realize what they were getting. And they wanted to get Spanish Inquisition because they thought that would, you know, provoke some interest in it. But anyway, I've long ago, as a writer, given up getting to choose my titles. So.
Well, I mean, this is a very involved historic situation. And of course, it does grow out of your own life story, if we will, which we'll get to. But the dynamics of the situation, we've got a dying woman in Seville where there's a strong-willed investigator, a padre, Dominican, who is so into self-flagellation, it's almost unbelievable, but he is. And he pursues Jews who converted to Catholicism with utter disbelief that there could be anything like real conversion. And this dying woman gives her daughter a pair of silver candlesticks of the title, and simultaneously in doing so, reveals to the daughter that she is Jewish heritage, which comes as a big surprise because they've not been practicing. But this has implications, major implications. She could be the subject of the padre's inquiry, but it also means that the young man that she's fallen in love with is not a suitable match for her, and she should marry a very good, upstanding, very respectable, strong, evidently strong, apparently, you know, super strong Catholic guy that her father has arranged for her to marry. And your story spins out from there.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I really got into it. Obviously, even though the bare bones basics, including all the names and the places and many of the events, even down to some of the dresses that are described, are actually from documents that I discovered in part of this research. And yet the story itself, I don't know, it just sprung from my head. And, you know, my old mentor, Alan Chews, who taught me a lot about craft when I was a student of his at George Mason University, he described the technique of writing in scenes. And so that's how I wrote this novel. I wrote them in scenes. And the scenes just sort of came to me. And once they were in my head, I could see everything. And, you know, was able to get it on the paper. It wasn't hard. People say, wasn't this difficult? Not really.
Well, I commend you because I think it worked very well. And I think you are evidence of the wisdom of Alan telling you, write it in scenes. And I think you've done it well. But the other thing, we may talk about this more later on, you were really, really good at crafting villains who, you know, could move the story along. You know, your characterizations are very necessary to the crafting of the story, you know, if you...
Well, Padre Dominguez, who is the Dominican priest who's head of the Inquisition in Sevilla at the moment this occurs, one of the things I had a hard time with, and again, one of my other instructors at George Mason had warned me, because I wrote this, you know, while I was still a student, I wrote parts of it, was not to make him so evil that he became a caricature. So to humanize him in some way, which I tried to do in various spots, but he was a real villain. I mean, he was, you know, like pure evil, and yet he was somebody who considered himself a man of God. And that tension, the irony there, you know, how do people do terrible things thinking that they're doing good was something that I tried very hard. And you mentioned the self-flagellation, which, by the way, I grew up in New Mexico. That's where my family came after they left Spain. And that practice of self-flagellation is practiced still in northern New Mexico. There are a whole group of people called penitentes, and they, during Easter week, you know, do a march, and they have the scourge, they've got the whips, and they're whipping their bat. So this idea of inflicting pain on yourself to expiate your guilt, an interesting way to present the dilemmas that this man faced, because clearly he was awful and he was doing terrible harm. And so you want him to be punished. Well, he punished himself.
But he didn't see it as punishment. He saw it as, there's not really a good word for it. It's not a reward. In a sense, it was kind of a psychological release, I think, for him.
Right. Even though he's a priest, he's also obsessed by sex and sexuality. And of course, that's repressed because he's a priest. So often this self-flagellation was in response to lust that he felt, involuntary lust. And so it was a way to try to tame those emotions, those desires. And, you know, whether it worked or not, you'll have to judge in the novel.
Right. Well, as a sexual being, he would have been perverted.
Yes. In today's world, he would have joined an S&M club. What can I say?
But I think one of the things that you do very well here is the views that others have of him. There's a helper, a monk, Tomas, but there's also the archbishop, and they have very different views. They come into sort of juxtaposition with him, and Tomas becomes one of his helpers, if you will, a very honest, caring kind of guy who sort of tells him what he is, and that's good. But the archbishop, who's asked to intercede and do something for the family that's endangered, basically says, I can't do anything. But he also understands that the church benefits from this kind of zealotry.
Yes. And in fact, this is a great debate in history and certainly in Jewish history. We all know the name Benjamin Netanyahu, but there was also a B. Netanyahu, who was his father, who was a scholar of the Spanish Inquisition. He wrote a 1,000-page book, which I cannot claim to have read every word of, but I certainly read in it. And he has a theory that this was persecution as the Nazis for blood, for race, that Jews were a distinct people and that it wasn't religion. And that was why, even if you converted to Catholicism, it didn't do you any good any more than, you know, secular Jews or converted Jews during the Holocaust were somehow not thought of as Jews. So that raises the question, well, why was the church doing this? And of course, before the reign of Isabel and Ferdinand, who were the Catholic monarchies that came, they were the ones who expelled the Jews in 1492. Before that period, Jews were very involved in Spanish society. They were in the court. They served in very prominent positions. And so the question is, were they really expelled because of the belief that they were heretics or not heretics, that, you know, they didn't believe in Jesus Christ and therefore they had to leave as the Muslims had to? And others believe that it was really all about power and it was about seizing their wealth. Because one thing most people don't know is, yes, Jews were expelled in 1492, and if you converted, you could stay. But the people who converted were much more likely to be merchants, shop owners, people who were involved in various trades, etc., and had wealth, because you could not take your wealth with you. In 1492, when you left, you could basically take the clothes on your back and a very minimal amount of your gold or silver. And so the people who stayed tended to be wealthier, which made a very attractive target for the church to be able to come in and seize their wealth.
Apparently, there's no accurate count, but the number of those who were forced out could be as many as 100,000.
Yes, there is no accurate count, nor is there an accurate count of the number of people who died during the Inquisition. You know, it wasn't tens of thousands. We know that. It may have been in the low thousands, but we know that many more were punished and put into dungeons, etc.
And circling back to your point about the merchants, it seems like that as they figured out how to do so, the monks and the priests who were coming, the padres were coming around, they would single out people and yes. they would confiscate their wealth and basically take away their means of renewing their wealth.
Right.
And then they would leave.
Yeah. And you know, by the way, you know, it sounds odd to us now, although there are authoritarian, totalitarian countries that do it to this day. People had to pay for being held. In other words, the church wasn't just feeding you. If you wanted to be fed, you had to have money that came in and provided for your well-being, even in prison.
Right. And if you were a donor to the church on a consistent basis, they might leave you alone longer than a...
Correct. You know, and it was also, again, like the totalitarian state today, when we think of, you know, the Soviet Union or North Korea or other such countries, it was neighbor against neighbor. It was, you know, spurned lover. The people came forward to denounce others. And once you were in prison and you were tortured, the whole purpose of torture was to have you produce names of other people who also practice Judaism secretly. And that's a very important part of this novel with respect to some of the minor characters.
Yes, you dramatize that very effectively. I mean, there's a mother who's on the rack and essentially sort of calls out her daughter's name unintentionally.
Right.
Implicating her.
Right. And that daughter then is in prison as well. And I'm not going to give away the plot, but she's also very important to the story and very important to an understanding of Padre Dominguez, the villain in the book.
Right.
Because, you know, he's just not mollified by anything, by a mother's love, by, you know, Christian charity. He has, you know, he just has none of this works for him.
Right. So let's back down to the preface. Because, as I alluded to, this is tied to your family story. And in the preface, you talk about how your grandmother would turn a plaster saint to the wall on Friday nights. And that aroused your curiosity, but you never asked her why.
Well, I did ask her, but she didn't ever give me a satisfactory explanation. There was, you know, I just assumed she was mad at the saint because he hadn't answered her prayers or something. But it did always strike me as odd. And there were a couple of other things. Again, I didn't know what it meant at the time. But when my grandfather died, they covered the mirrors in the house. And again, I just thought, well, this must be a Spanish custom or something. So, and I was 5 years old, so it's not like I was, you know, really able to discern the fine, you know, elements of religion here. So I, you know, I knew this, didn't think a whole lot about it. I still have that plaster saint. It was handed down to me, and it's very battered and, you know, not a beautiful saint. But it's an important figure in both in Spain and in New Mexico and some of Latin America. It's called the Niño de Atocha, and it is a medieval representation of the Christ child who used to visit prisoners. So that, you know, too, is sort of, if you know about this, it's sort of also meant something.
Well, and the origin story of this particular sort of statue is that when the Moors were controlling Spain, they imprisoned the men, and as a way of sort of punishing them, deepening their punishment, they would say that only your child under the age of 12 can bring you anything in prison. And so the guys who didn't have children or the children didn't live close by were sort of, you know, their suffering was complicated and additional. And then there began the story that there was this child who was coming in and giving water, giving food. And of course, the mothers and the women of the town had been praying in church. And so they went to pray thanks for this deliverance, if you will. And they noticed that on the statue of Mary, to whom they were praying, that the Jesus figure had worn booties or leather shoes. And they, you know, everything came together for them.
Correct. And in New Mexico, in a small town in north of Santa Fe called Chimayo, there is it's called Santuario de Chimayo. And there is a church there, and you will find that people bring shoes for the figure of the Niño de Atocha. So there are little booties and little children's shoes that are left there in the Santuario.
So taking the story one step further, you were contacted about the PBS show, and this habit of your grandmother's became the thing you wanted to investigate.
Right. So Finding Your Roots, a popular PBS show with Henry Louis Gates, contacted me in their very first year. I was on the final episode with their first year 12 years ago. And, you know, they said, well, you know, we want to reveal about your family. Well, I was very arrogant. I said, well, I know all about my family. I know when they came in, you know, 1601 in Santa Fe, et cetera. And they said, well, there's got to be some mysteries. And I'm racking my brain. And so it occurred to me, oh, gee, my grandmother and the Niño de Atocha. So I mentioned that. And that was the clue that got them looking in the Inquisition records in Spain when we went to Sevilla for the episode, and they revealed all this that they learned in Spain.
Now, you found record there, or that they found. Yeah, they found of your, what, 10th great-grandmother?
Actually, Benita, the character in the book, who is the mother who's dying, she was mentioned in a book about the Spanish Inquisition from the late 1500s. That she was under investigation. Her name appears. Her maiden name was Orozco, which is actually a known converso name in Spain. So
that was my question. So she was listed as being under
investigation. Yeah, she was listed in this book about the Inquisition.
Do you know the outcome of that?
No, I don't know. What I do know is that her daughter and her daughter's husband, Francisco, the one she ends up marrying, do come to the New World. And so that gave me the bare bones of the story. And without too much of a spoiler, if you read the preface, you know that they are eventually going to make it here because I'm here. But that was the bare bones of the story. And as I say, because they were a prominent family, wealthy family, they had estate sales. They had slaves. They had property. And so there are records of all of that, including the records of their voyage to the New World. So all of that was documented.
And let's talk about the depiction of slavery that you have here, because that was one of the things that intrigued me. It's a sub-theme, if you will, but an important one, because you created a character, Esperanza, who is very key to the goings-on. She's a kind of back and forth character who moves within this world, and she is a slave. You also have another character, Concha, who is also back and forth. But what you depict, dramatize very effectively, is free will and the fact that the slave doesn't have free will.
Esperanza, even though Esperanza was raised alongside Guiomar, they're about the same age. She was raised by Benita, the mother, and she was loved. Slavery in Spain at that period was different. It was not people not on plantations. They were not working the fields. They were part of the household. And there was also indentured servitude, and you could be one or the other. But at the end of the day, no matter how well treated you were, whether or not you believed that, you know, this family loved you, you were still not free. You couldn't make up, you know, your mind about what you wanted to do. You couldn't leave, for example. And if you had a child, that child could be sold. And of course, you know, because slaves were property in this grotesque world, if a child was born, that increased your wealth. But only if you sold the child. All of that sort of plays into the novel.
And because it's not the Southern U.S. form of slavery, I think you had a chance to evoke some themes within the realm of slavery that I haven't seen in other writings. And so it gave me something to think about, that lack of free will, but how one can form bonds, as happens here, but how one can also be, in a sense, repelled mm-hmm. in the relationship, the slave to owner kind of relationship.
Right. And Esperanza, by the way, for those who don't speak Spanish, means hope. That is what the word means. But interestingly, Esperanza, too, her name was taken from the records of my family's journey to the New World, because they not only came with themselves and their children, but also with several slaves.
To finish the theme of slavery, you also show the master class, if you will, having different attitudes. And some are in favor of releasing them and some are not. And you do an effective dramatization there.
Right. Yeah. Because they could, there was manumission. You could, in fact. And I think it was more frequent in that society than it was certainly in the United States. It was pretty rare, even when the father of some of the children who were born to enslaved women, even though the father might have been the plantation owner, they often didn't get free, not even when he died. So that was very different. But that whole theme of what it means to be free, and no matter how good you think your life is, it isn't unless you are actually free.
Do you think the level of reliance on slaves made a difference in that regard?
Well, you know, it wasn't like here where you had mass slavery, where people were enslaved and they basically produced everything of value for their masters. They ran the plantation without their labor. And of course, there was indentured servitude here in the United States as well, as there was in the, one of the characters in the novel is an indentured. It's actually the son of Concha is indentured. And that was a different avenue. But, you know, one of the things I think we have lost appreciation for is what being an indentured servant meant, even here in the New World. You know, it sounds so horrible to us. But on the other hand, for people to get from Europe to the New World, if they had no means whatsoever, it was a way of getting credit. You know, you said, I'll work for you for a certain number of years in return for your paying my passage, giving you room and board when I'm here and teaching you a trade.
And let's go to the crafting of this, from this minor theme to the larger crafting of characters and stuff. I mean, much of this, you say, came to you from history, from mm-hmm. research. But you had to have villains, you had to have conflict, and some of that was in the story as it came to you. You had to set it down. You had to find a way to tell the story and create that energy that moves the story along and pulls the reader through.
Well, that's true. You know, in the writing process, one of the things, again, that Alan Chews taught me, as others did in the program at George Mason, was that you had to know everything there was to know about your character. You know, you can't just put a name and have a physical description. Where did that person come from? What was their life before the novel? You really had to create a person. And so that was very helpful to me. And I actually did, in the process of writing, try to come up, at least for the main characters, with that. I mean, I give a small description of Esperanza's childhood and how she is taken from her African village, ripped essentially from her mother's arms as a young child. But you have to have that in your mind. You know, that has to be an important part. That's one of the ways you create a character, is they don't appear, you know, just on whatever page you put them in your novel. They have to have had a life before they make their appearance in the novel.
I'm also thinking about what I would call a soft villain, Jose Marcos.
Yes, yes. He was one of my favorite characters. I won't say whether or not he was inspired by a real person or not, maybe. But yes, he's not really a villain, you know. He's just this sort of handsome, dashing guy that this young girl falls in love with, and she thinks he's going to run off with her. And after she finds out she's Jewish, she never quite tells him she's Jewish, but she sort of hints at it, and he begins to suspect it. And then he just becomes a coward. But he sort of can't leave her alone. And again, I didn't want it just to end there. I thought, he's got to come back here at some point. And also, it was important to set up a foil for Guimar's marriage with Francisco. She doesn't want to marry Francisco. He's beneath her. He's a candle maker. She's a wealthy girl from a merchant family. And she's forced to marry this guy who was her, you know, neighbor. He lived in the neighborhood. And again, that comes from the records. This was one of the things that they found intriguing about the story. Why this marriage? And they said, you know, there was not like there was a birth, you know, 7 months later or something. It wasn't, you know, a shotgun wedding. And so she didn't want to marry him. So I have to have her continue to be obsessed by this handsome man who is just, he is really beneath her, but she doesn't know it. So he comes in and out to the very end of the book. He's there.
Right. And I call him a soft villain because you do a good job of having him manipulate her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As you know, this is what happens when you're infatuated with someone, right? I mean, you know that you shouldn't love that person. You know that they're, you know, really not worthy of you, but they keep pulling you in. So
did you do this consciously as a storyteller in terms of like, okay, this is a way of manipulating my character so that I use him, as I say, as a soft villain, and I use her vulnerability to him without making her, I mean, she's gullible and vulnerable, but she's not herself bad.
That's right. And I think Guiomar is a complex character. You know, she's not a heroine that you just love, the minute you start reading about her. Esperanza is much more attractive as a character, as a human being, than Guiomar is. Guiomar, particularly at the beginning of the novel, she's a spoiled rich girl. And, you know, she's beautiful and she has everything and she wants her way. But she grows, I think. I tried to make her grow over the course of the novel. She matures. She becomes, you know, her relationship to her children. I know some people who read the book were very, you know, shocked that, you know, she didn't, you know, immediately love all of her children, particularly her daughter, who was not beautiful, who had a mark on her face, a birthmark. And sort of her learning to love that child was also important. So I tried to make that, you know, to give Guiomar depth so that she's not just, you know, a cutout heroine, but to show her changing over the course of the novel.
Well, and that's also tricky, right, for writers, is to create a character who is sympathetic but not entirely endearing, particularly right at the beginning of the novel.
Yeah, if you want to have movement in. You know, Esperanza, as they say, is a much more purely good character. She's, you know, she is just sort of more innately good than Guiomar. But Guiomar begins to show strength. So she has to assume this role, you know, once she becomes basically the matriarch of the family and has to, you know, host people. And there's a lot of dinner parties that go on. Again, sort of figuring out scenes. How do I create movement? How do I create dialogue? And there's a lot of dialogue in it, which I didn't really even realize as I was writing it until I heard the audible version of the book. And I realized, oh my goodness, there's so much dialogue here.
How long did it take you to write this?
Well, off and on 10 years. Because I have, you know, very busy career, and mostly, you know, political and as a writer and on public policy and current events. And so, you know, I wrote it in bits and pieces. You know, maybe I would only spend, you know, an hour in a day working on it. And that's hard. That was one of the hard things in putting it together to the end. And again, rereading it, I found a couple of mistakes I made that, you know, continuity that carrying that story and every facet of it and every detail of it in your brain over a 10-year period is very difficult. Also, I continued to do research as I was writing. It's not like I did all the research and then wrote it. I researched and wrote it at the same time.
So, but it wasn't like a struggle to do it that kept it going
No,
for 10 years. Like
it was never a struggle. When I would sit down at the computer, it just would come to me. That has always been the case with, if I have a kernel of an idea in mind, I've published a number of short stories. And with each of them, once I had that kernel, the writing is just not difficult. And part of that may be my training. I've been a syndicated columnist for 30 years. I've retired. But learning to put words down on the page, you know, I had good training for that.
But putting the words down on the page doesn't mean one always puts the right words down.
That's true. I don't think I'm a great stylist. So, you know, if you read my sentences, it's not like, you know, reading some sentences where in some, you know, books where you will remember that sentence for the rest of your life. It's not like that. But I do think I tried to use my senses, taste, smell, sound, touch, to give it life. You know, I wanted to use description to put you in the place. And I spent a lot of time in Sevilla. I've probably been there a dozen times. And so the streets, the churches, everything that's described, I've been there. It's not from, you know, research. It's from actually having been in that place. What I would do is that I would go back and, like, when I wrote about the cathedral in Sevilla, I went back to make sure that things I described, was this painting or was that statue there in, you know, in the 1500s, late 1500s. And so tried to, you know, make sure that I wasn't putting something anachronistically.
Being there probably did a lot for being able to evoke the atmosphere.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It is, you know, Sevilla is like one of the fabulous cities of the world. So.
And Alan probably talked to you about appealing to all the senses, use them all in the scenes.
And yeah, Alice McDermott was also very helpful to me. Alice, I took a workshop in Ireland with Alice, and she taught me there was one scene where Guillermar is walking along a wrought iron fence and she hears a canary. And so sort of having her hear the canary before she sees the canary is important. Canaries play an important role. And interestingly, in my own life, my grandmother still had canaries, you know, 400 years after they left Maine. My grandmother always had her canaries.
Gotcha. Shopping the book, did you have any trouble? Adventures?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, yes. I had a tremendous difficulty getting a publisher. And eventually, Adam Bellow and David Bernstein of Wicked Sun, they liked it. They liked the story. That imprint is primarily in Jewish material. So they do a lot of autobiographies, memoirs, public policy books, and not that many novels. So, but they were willing to give it a try.
How did you come to them?
I know them. David Bernstein was actually in my oldest son's wedding. So I've known David since he was 18 years old. And Adam Bellow had actually come to me about one of the short stories that I had published when I was still in graduate school. And I published it in Commentary Magazine. And Adam read it there and came to me. And I actually had a book of short stories about North Korea. These were all took place in North Korean prison camps primarily. And he was interested, but then we ended up not doing it. And that book is still waiting for a publisher. I have not been able to find one.
Are you shopping it?
I haven't. I thought I would see if this book was, you know, successful, maybe I'd have more interest in it.
Are you going to follow this novel with a kind of a sequel? Or?
I've actually written a couple of pages of the opening of the sequel. Initially, when I planned this, and I was, you know, at the very young age of 65. I'm quite a bit older now. I thought, well, it's going to be a trilogy. And this is the first book. The second book was going to take place in colonial territorial New Mexico. And then the last book was going to bring us into the 20th century. But now I've condensed the next two books into one in my mind. And it will follow this same family, the Armijo family, who ended up staying in Mexico for 100 years. They were part of the reconquest of New Mexico after the Pueblo Indian revolt in the late 17th century. And they ended up coming to Santa Fe in 1701 and then settling in Albuquerque, which is where my family is from.
Was Santa Fe Santa Fe at that time period? Or?
Yeah, Santa Fe was founded in the late 1500s, early 1600s. And the Chavez side of my family, the captain who was on the expedition, who's my direct ancestor. He was part of that Oñate expedition that founded New Mexico and Santa Fe in 1601.
So is that a character that you follow? I mean, is it?
That's an interesting question. Yes, I will, but not with him. It'll be later because it'll be when the Armijos come. And that was the other interesting thing about my family. They kept intermarrying these two families, the Chavez and the Armijo families intermarried across generations. My grandfather was Ambrosio Chavez de Armijo, and my grandmother was Petra Armijo de Chavez. So they, you know, I don't know if they were first cousins, but they were closely related.
Gotcha. Can we go back to the short stories? You said that you had published some and had a book. They're set in North Korea.
Yes. So this comes from, I worked at the United Nations Human Rights Subcommission for 4 years during the early 90s. And I was appointed special rapporteur on the use of sex during wartime. And so I was introduced to the comfort women. I met a comfort woman who is the central character in this series. These are interconnected short stories. I met her actually in Seoul, but she was from the north. Of course, by now, you know, the country's separated, but it was not, obviously, when she was born. So, yeah, so I had a whole series of them. Must be a tortured soul because torture plays a role in these stories as well. I don't know where it comes from, deep down inside somewhere. And it was interesting. I tried to get it published in 2017. It was right when Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump were having their love affair. And I thought there would be great interest in a book about, it wasn't about Kim Jong-un, it was about his father and his grandfather, because it takes place in an earlier period. But they said, nah, there's not going to be any, you know, there's no audience for a book of short stories about North Korea. Well, there was obviously an audience to get them published as short stories. So, but, you know, getting a book of short stories is harder to get published. But
yes, that's what everybody says. And everybody also says, including people I've interviewed on this podcast, go with a small press.
Yes, I need to do that. And I don't know who my agent, I mean, I've had agents for all of my books and I think they were going for some of the bigger names, but yeah. I would like to revisit it because I actually think they are my finest writing stories. They're a real punch in the gut.
Well, the potential is certainly there for that, isn't there?
Yep. Yeah. So maybe I'll, Bill, maybe encourage me. You know, people would be surprised to hear this given my career. I'm a terrible self-promoter. I've just never been good at it. I mean, you know, people come to me. You came to me. I didn't go.
This is true.
Yeah. It's not a good trait when you're an author. To me, the writing is what's important. I get it out there. I get it on the page. And I feel once I've created it, that satisfies me. I should want people to read it, obviously. I'm thrilled when people do read it, but the motivation really is internal.
I get that. But I do think that particularly the ideas that would inform, here's my imagination, obviously, but the ideas that would inform the comfort women and your interviews with them and that firsthand gathered information seems potentially quite strong.
I'm going to send you a couple of the stories and you read them and you tell me. Maybe you'll read them and say, oh my God, this is no good. But maybe you'll like them. I mean, as I say, it's hard to get short stories published. I had one published by a different group, but I had three of them, one, two, three, I guess, published by Commentary Magazine, which is, you know, primarily a political magazine. But in its heyday, it published all the great, you know, writers of the mid-century. So
if you have to choose, which one are you going to do the combined sequel to the novel?
Well, maybe I should try to promote the short story book and then see if I can finish and write. The short story book is complete. It doesn't need rewriting. I don't think I have to go back and reread them, but I don't think it did. They flow together. And as I say, it's a theme. It starts with this woman who's based on this woman I met in Seoul, living in this tiny, tiny little space in Seoul, whose life was destroyed by the Japanese because these women were rejected after they came home. They'd been forced into prostitution. Their husbands didn't want them. Their family didn't want them. So, you know, I think it has potential.
Seems to me like it would.
Well, anybody listening to this who's interested, I'm here.
Yeah, send those out and get back to work on that sequel. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. This has been a fascinating conversation. And I must tell you that from reading the novel, I learned so much more about the Spanish Inquisition. To me, it had always been a kind of vague time period in history. I hadn't understood how directed it was and purely anti-Semitic it was.
Yes. Well, they also went after Muslims, and they went after various what they considered heretic groups, Protestant sects, because it was in the period the book's written in is when the Protestant sects begin to proliferate. But yeah, and you know, given what's going on in the world today and anti-Semitism today, it's relevant. I'm actually speaking on January 13th at the Stryker Center, which is at Temple Emmanuel in New York City. And I expect that audience will be very interested in the ties between the story that's told there and what's happening in the world today.
Well, that was my point. I think it is very relevant to what we're looking at going on in the world today. And as I was reading the book, I kept being struck over and over again by how relevant it was. And yeah, even though this is kind of brought down to a microscopic story, the background about it, it just seems so relevant.
Well, I'm really glad to hear you say that because I have to tell you, I am not a great reader of historical fiction. And so I didn't know what the conventions were. I didn't, you know, it wasn't like I started out to write a historical fiction. I just had a story I wanted to tell. And my reading habits are more in the classics than they are anything else. I don't even read as much contemporary fiction as I should. So I didn't have a lot of preconceived notions of what I should or shouldn't do in writing this.
maybe you've said two very important things. Don't start with too many preconceived notions. And being steeped in the classics may equip you well for writing historic fiction, or any kind of fiction for that matter.
Well, it's interesting. Again, I keep invoking Alan's name, but he was a very important influence in my life. And Alan, one of the things he made us do as students was to read. And of course, I had an undergraduate degree in English literature, and I'm a prolific reader. But he then would have us do what he called pastiches, which is to take a story that we'd read and then write a story in that voice and style. And many of my short stories were done as exercises in his class. And so for the would-be writers out there, it's a wonderful technique. And you develop your own style, but it's helpful to have, you know, models and to try to model and get good at that, and then you develop your own.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you for listening to Upstart Crow. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider leaving a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Your feedback helps others find the show. You can also watch full episodes and clips from Upstart Crow on our YouTube channel. Be sure to follow us on social media and visit upstartcrow.org for more information about our episodes, guests, and ways you can support the podcast. You'll find all of those links in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time right here on Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio.